word, but I'm an assistant professor at Drexel School of Public Health in the Department of Community Health and Prevention. I got my PhD in Community Health Sciences from UCLA, did a minor in demography, and I was a fellow of the California Center for Population Research, and did my MPH work at Berkeley. I'm going to set the stage by talking about the systematic cross-disciplinary lit review on community resilience that I did in collaboration with William Kalisis, also Carmen Cronin, and also Connie Owens, who's here today. We have nothing to disclose. So I've long been interested in community resilience because it's been a concept in psychology for a long time. Individuals' ability to be resilient in the face of adversity or trauma, to be able to cope, to be able to move on. And what I've seen a lot, and I'm sure a lot of you have seen in your work in communities and in your community health research, is the ability of communities to be resilient in the face of adversity, whether it's an acute event, a disaster, or a trauma like a shooting or a violent episode, or chronic like poverty or unemployment or other stressors or shocks to the community that folks experience on a chronic basis. And then, of course, there was more attention brought to this with Presidential Order HSPD 21 by President Bush, which was really about developing a national strategy for public health and mental preparedness, more in terms of bioterrorism and post-disaster, but really set the stage for funding and thinking and attention to the issue and the concepts of community resilience. So our study purpose was to look at the theoretical influences and definitions of community resilience being used now in multiple fields, to understand how it's been applied to public health, and what domains have been talked about in relation to community resilience, whether in terms of theoretical frameworks or empirical work or programmatic work. And then to explore those domains with a series of focus groups in a Mantua neighborhood in West Philadelphia, which is adjacent to us in at Drexel, to ground truth these domains, to find out what it means to the community. How can we move forward with a framework for community resilience if we don't understand what it means to communities? And then to make recommendations for a unifying framework to inform practical application in public health. So just a quick overview of our methods. We search multiple databases. We use 21 different search terms. You can see some examples here. And these are the disciplines that we found the most substantive work had been done on community resilience. And you see it ranges from public health to, of course, psychology and community psychology to environmental sciences, emergency management, and physics, where the term actually originates. We had a four-step screening process where we reviewed titles and then abstracts and then articles and then their citations, and we coded them by relevancy. And you can see that our search returned over 1,500 articles, but by the time we got through our screening process, we included 35 papers that were highly relevant. We then read them, and we noted their emerging themes, and then we discussed amongst ourselves to identify emerging themes of domains of community resilience in the literature. So just a word about what we found about theoretical background. Well, of course, community resilience is informed by asset-based community development, informed by McKnight and Kretzmann, of course, starting in the early 90s, about supporting communities to use their shared assets, meaning capacities and strengths, to solve their own problems. It's also informed by the capabilities approach, Amartya Sen, and the freedom to achieve valuable beings or doings, or what he calls what a person may value being or doing. It tends to be a little bit more on the individual level, but it certainly speaks to the issue of assets and strengths and capacities. It's also informed by civic engagement, which is informed by the work of Putnam, Bobo, Gilliam, and others, which is about working to make a difference in the civic life of a community. It tends to be a little bit more individually focused, but of course a lot of folks have looked at that at the neighborhood level to relate that to some health outcomes. And it's informed by empowerment. Nina Wallerstein and Meredith Minkler, among others, a process by which people, and also at different levels, organizations and communities, gain mastery over the issues important to them in order to solve them. And then just moving a little bit further, we also see social cohesion, social capital, and collective efficacy informing community resilience. Social cohesion being that level of social connectedness, shared norms, networks between folks, the trust between them, and then how much they're reinforced by reciprocity, meaning that I watch your kids, you watch mine, I watch your house, you watch mine. And then social capital, which like financial capital, is sort of the existence of both social cohesion, but also the appropriable, or meaning the mobilizable ability, a capability of the community to take action together. And then collective efficacy, which is the ability of residents to actually take the action, their efficacy to work together and collectively together. All of this informs community resilience. In terms of definitions, we found 31 unique definitions and no universally accepted definition. We moved from physics, where I didn't know that was showing, the origins of the term, which is really about the ability to store strain energy, deflect elasticity under a load without breaking or being deformed. But do you see the emergence of a definition that is about something having some trauma and returning to its former state? In ecology, they talk about positive adaptation in response to adversity, and I like the idea of adaptation that comes with this definition. And I also like the parts of the definition are about it being dynamic and changing. It's not the absence of vulnerability. It's not an inherent characteristic, which means that it can be built, it can be changed, and it's not static. In sociology, we start seeing more of the chronic adversity component of definitions, the ability to persist and the ability to adapt to change, unforeseen circumstances, and risks. And then from a review of definitions, which occurred in 2013, in disaster preparedness and response, we see the most complete definition that I've seen, which is the capability to anticipate risk, limit impact, and bounce back rapidly through survival, adaptability, evolution, and growth in the face of turbulent change. So in this definition, we see that it's not just about bouncing back, but it's also about protection or absorbing the impact of that adversity in the community as well. So we identified through our lit review four common domains. The first one being the social environment. And related, of course, to the theoretical background of community resilience, we see a lot of themes in all of the articles about community resilience, about connectivity, about cohesion, also about inclusivity and not exclusivity as being important to a community being resilient. We see a sense of neighborhood attachment, community pride, and belonging being a piece of that, again, another component of connectivity and inclusivity. We see sort of the civic engagement, the active resident participation. But what I like about the literature that we found in community resilience is that it moves beyond the individual and to the collective, about collective empowerment, about collective efficacy, and about the ability to take action and to be involved in decision making. And so those were all the subdomains that we found, all the sub-themes that we found under the domain of the social environment. The second environment were resources. And this was a variety of different resources that we found, that it was the human capital, the skills and the people power in a community, just like financial capital or social capital, that it exists and can be mobilized upon, right? And then it's also the organizations and the partnerships and the coalitions and the connectivity at the organizational level that can get and use and be able to mobilize resources for the needs of the community. And also, it's also about leadership and leadership development and, you know, who is a natural leader and building their skills and their capacity to lead and to be able to mobilize and to be able to, you know, to be able to use that capital that exists, that human capital in every community. The third domain is the built environment. And this was really about, of course, the desirable features in the neighborhood or community, more of those and fewer of the undesirable neighborhoods. But beyond what we're used to thinking about in terms of positive and healthy built environment, the green space, the recreational facilities, the healthy food sources, it's all about the places to gather socially as well, for informal social interactions, for building those social ties and for reinforcing them. And then places for organizing, for associations to meet, for them to come together, for them to plan and take action. And it's also, of course, about the accessibility of those desirable features, transportation and walkability to them, safety, and then, of course, coming from urban design, neighborhood design that facilitates that social interaction. So, you know, fewer of those walled compounds of houses and more of the front stoop and the front porch effect. And then the fourth was sort of the macro context, the structural factors. Of course, the economic climate, economic and employment opportunities, poverty and racism, and of course the sociodemographic profile of the community, which in turn, as we know, predicts how they experience poverty or racism. And then, of course, population stability, because the more stable a community, the more able they are to build common values and social norms and interactions and all the capital and cohesion that we've been speaking about. So when we talked about this with our community folks, what we heard is that community resilience is something that's practiced every day, whether it's a violent event, a shooting, or it's poverty. And in fact, one of our participants said, and I couldn't say this better if I had thought about this myself, is that poverty is the hand around the throat of the community. If you don't see a better illustration of how structural factors impact community life and community resilience, I charge you with that. When we asked them what community resilience meant to them or what they think makes a resilient community, they talked about the most frequently mentioned topics. They mentioned all the domains that we talked about, and the most frequently mentioned was the role of youth involvement, getting youth passionate and involved and engaged and giving them the career and the leadership skills to be able to participate as leaders and being positive agents of change in their communities. They talked about that need for places to interact socially, to interact informally, as well as formally in terms of associational meetings. They talked about all the built environment barriers, which makes it hard for them to work together or to make their community healthier. And they talked about capacity building. They talked about the need for both cross-sectional collaboration and resource building so that they could pool their resources and pool their power and be able to have a greater impact on decision-making and on funding and on other positive inputs into the community. So the rest of my colleagues today are going to talk about the ways that they've been applying community resilience and community resilience building in their work. But I wanted to, of course, highlight these four. The Thrive tool from the Prevention Institute has been around since 2005, and it's really about general community resilience building, understanding and prioritizing what within the community are assets that can be used to help improve health and safety. They're actually going to be presenting later this afternoon, and that's Rachel Davis's work. And then the other three are really more about disaster preparedness, but give us a lot of experience about how these can be applied in public health. And, of course, one of them is the RAND Health, and Anita will be talking a bit more about their work in community resilience and public health. And the Community Resilience System from the CARE Institute and CART, which is about enhancing community resilience to disasters by engaging community members in measuring resilience as well as building resilience. There are a few measurement tools that are related to those applications in public health that are mostly disaster-focused. There have also been a couple of cross-sectional studies which look at health measures cross-sectionally with some resilience measures, one in England, one in New Zealand, and took a look at what neighborhoods, communities were doing better than would be expected from sociodemographic characteristics. But we found no longitudinal studies of resilient communities over time to see what they're able to achieve or to see what kind of health changes they're able to make or effects of community resilience building efforts over time. And although most tools were developed for disaster preparedness or response, a lot of them have wonderful domains that are applicable across any kind of public health adversity or threat. So we have four recommendations for applying a community resilience framework in public health. The first is to be clear about the desired outcome. It's been used as a predictor, sort of as a process, and as an outcome. And so if we're going to be doing community resilience building in public health, or if we're going to be doing observational research of what makes a community resilient and what it means for health, we need to be clear about what's the end goal or proof of success. Is it a more resilient community, either overall or among these domains? Is it improved health? Or is it the increase in the action that improves health? And so we need to be clear about that. We need to be clear about, do communities want to return to where they were after the adversity or where they should be? And should we be looking at communities as constantly evolving and improving and not necessarily returning just to where they were before? We recommend considering it as both a chronic, consider both chronic and acute stressors in community resilience building, that the domains are the same. And it's possible that resilience is, the demands are greater in communities to experience more of these constant chronic stressors like poverty and violence and that require more sustained resilience. We need to understand the mechanisms that link community resilience to health, you know, in terms of protection, adaptation, stability, improvement, or worsening. And then that leads me to recommending to understand that it's dynamic, that, you know, resilience can can prevent adverse events, or it can unfortunately lead to a reduced quality of community life or individual well-being, but it can also absorb that adverse event and lead to the same quality of life. Or, as I heard from a community leader who spoke at our Medicaid expansion rally on Saturday, that Katrina provided the opportunity for their community to organize in a way that they hadn't before. So the adverse event can lead to an improved quality of life, of community life. And so we need to, and then this can happen over and over and in lots of different feedback loops and dynamic ways. So we need to be clear about that. And lastly, we should focus our research on the overachieving communities, the ones that are doing better than expected, that we can learn from them. We will learn the most of studying what works and looking at sociodemographically similar communities over time with different levels of community resilience, to see how that's working and to see what's working and what we can then take from that to build in other communities. Thank you.